Welcome back to Overserved, everybody. I am Ari Vendersky, and I'm here with my good friend and awesome co-host,
Maggie Hennessy. Hello.
And our kick-ass producer, Ernest Wilkins.
Hi, everybody.
And we are taking a deep dive with the people behind Chicago's thriving culinary scene. Most weeks, we invite on guests a chef, a sommelier, a restaurateur, a farmer, or another one of the fabulous people who plies with all the food and drink we'd love to enjoy, to learn more about their story, who they are, why they got into this crazy food world, and what makes them tick. And currently, how they're navigating and surviving during the COVID-19 pandemic. This week, we are super, super excited to have master sommelier and restaurateur and friend Alpana Singh in the Zoom hot seat.
Yay!
Oh. And we are also going to break from protocol a little bit because we have a lot to discuss before we get into the discussion with Alpana, and we want to involve her in the current events conversation this time. So first and foremost, let's talk about the big closings this week. I mean, while restaurants have been opening, which we want to get into since you do own one, three bigger profile restaurants have closed, one being Blackbird, which was incredibly sad news to find out. After 22 years, the team behind Blackbird, Chef Paul Kahn, who we've had on the show, his partners Donnie Medea, Tara Alexander, and Edward Satan, have decided to close the iconic restaurant, their crown jewel in the one-off hospitality group, Michelin-starred, and basically saying that because of COVID, it just didn't make sense for them to open a restaurant of that caliber at 25%.
And also, just given it's this little modern white box, and it's, you know, it's the definition of communal seating. I mean, you could touch you could grab food off the table next to you if you wanted.
You're literally almost dining with everybody next to you.
It kind of was, and I think, which was part of what made it such a intoxicating atmosphere to be in. But yeah, it feels like this time is, as we're seeing this shift due to COVID, it's sort of exposing some of these realities of restaurants that for the next 12, 18 months are also something to consider. You know, that if everyone is spaced six feet apart inside Blackbird, how many people can they fit in there anyway?
Right. Exactly. You know, and they also at the same time announced that they were closing Cafe Cancale, which was their French restaurant that they opened just last year, which was phenomenal. Maggie and I ate there together and had one of my most favorite meals of 2019. I don't know if it's for the same reason. I don't know if it's for financial reasons, because there's more space there, but again, it's not that big inside. And then Bad Hunter, one of the, I guess, premier plant-based restaurants in Chicago, which was followed by plant-focused, sorry, because they weren't entirely plant-based. But like Clever Rabbit also did not reopen. Yeah. So those were two plant-focused restaurants that we've lost.
And they're from, fairly successful, well-funded, small restaurant groups. So you make you realize kind of the extent. So I guess it would be great to hear, Alpana, because you've been on this scene and at this, high level for so long as a sommelier. What does it mean to lose Blackbird for this community and for the restaurant industry?
Well, I think, something like Blackbird, I mean, I moved to Chicago in 2000, so Blackbird was about 2 years old around there. But I mean, if you were a sommelier or wine professional in the early 2000s in Chicago, you basically lived at Blackbird because it was the go-to place where winemakers wanted to have their wine tastings, wine luncheons. Belinda Chang and I would have a standing Monday lunch reservation there. We were, two young women in our 20s at the top of our game, celebrating every Monday with Armagnac, and then we'd go shoe shopping.
Oh, I love it. Living.
It's a landmark in Chicago, but it's also a landmark in so many people's lives for celebrating these, occasions. And, the thing about life is you just don't notice that the time does tick away until you look up one day and you're like, what, 22 years?
Yeah.
I just, like the other day, Ratatouille has been out for 13 years.
Oh my God, it has? Oh God, I love that movie.
And so it just, you know, I think we all took for granted that it would always be here. Yeah. And
right.
I can't imagine the difficult, you know, having, you know, I mean, been in a situation myself where two of the restaurants I started closed. And I know that feeling of like, it's just the loss, you know, the mourning, the anguish, the bittersweet nature of it. And I think especially for, you know, a company like One Off Hospitality, just the nostalgic sort of, you know, just how much, the, like you said, crown jewel. You know, you yeah. always want to keep sort of the first one. You know, I think about Rich Melman and RJ Gruntz. You know,
totally.
And right. how that sense of pride of like, my first one is still there. So, you know, I'm hopeful that they do own the building and they'll pivot to something, you know, that will, and Maggie, you said it best, you know, I mean, that's the thing that people miss in this conversation, that we have to think about the next 12 to 18 months, and restaurant mm-hmm. years are like dog years.
Yeah.
You know, that's a long time in restaurants.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
You know, I mean, these
especially
are
if you're cash flow dependent, you know, night to night.
You know, and I'm actually really concerned because restaurants do pay 30 days behind. And we can't forget about the conversation about the pressures of the restaurant business even before COVID started.
Mm-hmm.
Brains had put out exactly. that, you know, article about the restaurant bubble bursting and, you know, the pressures with, you know, rent increases, wage increases, food increases, property tax increases.
Oh, my God. The list goes on. And so you're...
I think I just need to go to sleep right now.
And sleep. Well, this sort of...
Yeah.
It almost like sped up what was already sort of what was already happening or no, compounded
right.
it.
Exactly. But I will say the silver lining in all of this is the fact that, you know, if you can take your existing business model and pivot it and you have the finances for a reset, you can do a complete rebrand. You
yeah.
know, I think a perfect example of that is Alinea. You know, Alinea.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, just Alinea doing takeout 6 months ago. Like, are they in trouble? Like, what's going on over there?
Yeah.
But now it's revolutionary and groundbreaking. And, you know, and so if you can kind of, like I said, if you have the resources to make it happen, you can rebuild your business model and it doesn't seem like it's coming out of left field. Like, I could literally start selling bubble gum at Terre & Vine and be like, oh, okay, I guess that's
your Oh, so this is, but this is, it's a really good time to sort of ask you, you know, Chicago entered phase 4. So indoor dining at 25% began last Friday.
Well, phase 4 right now, as long
we're
as
in phase
behaves.
Right, exactly. So,
which
but
in,
we're,
and we're,
so
seeing,
we're now like a little bit into this. What, from your perspective, how do you feel about sort of this phase? Where are you with Terre & Vine and Evanston in this process?
So we have 50% capacity, but we're actually restructuring our business model. We took out the high boys in the bar because the bar is, you know, we have this existing space and we're like, okay, so it's just sort of guessing consumer habits of what people are going to be comfortable with. Thankfully, we have a pretty awesome outdoor patio. Aria, I know you've been up to Terre.
Yeah.
So can, you know, speak to our patio, but you know, we have like 60 seats outside. We also have a very large private dining room that we can use to spread people out.
Mm.
And, you know, we've been open for about 3 or 4 weeks now and people are very happy to sit outside. You know, winter's going to be a different conversation. But we do have, like I said, just a lot more space to move people around to create that social distancing. And then especially in an area like Evanston where you do have, you know, a more sort of established clientele as far as age.
Yeah. You know, a little bit more
their health. I mean, we're all concerned about our health, but you know, the bar, like, okay, well, I can't, you know, this is a perfectly good space, but what can we do to, you know, to maximize revenue out of it? So we're actually going to turn it into a wine shop.
And so, that's great.
Yeah, I have a shelves installed and I'm actually going shopping right now and putting together, you know, wine shop. I think that what we really need to do is not only think about the short term, but also the long term of what happens if we do bump back to phase 3.
Yep.
And we got to like pull the pandemic plan again.
Yeah.
You know, if there is another shutdown and you have to stay nimble, you have to stay quick. You have to just be ready to different scenarios if need be. And so, you know, people, and we have a little bit more, you know, people did not stop drinking during the pandemic, which was
that's
great.
For sure.
In fact, people had started drinking a lot more.
Yeah, so cocktail kits, wine bottles.
Yeah, I mean, wine.com, wine.com reported like a 350% increase April year over year
or something like that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. So we sort of navigate within that and just kind of slide right in and sort of fit what consumers are looking for.
It's cool because you have that built-in trust. I mean, everybody knows you for wine. So
exactly.
Like, of course. No,
and they want your recommendations. I mean,
exactly.
It's like, so do you need to get a different, do you have to get a retail license or are you allowed to sell?
City of Chicago, from my understanding, you can sell wine to go as long as it doesn't exceed your on-premise sales. And then the city of Evanston, there are different licenses that you can get, yes. And so, of course, the cocktails to go are now legal, provided they meet the requirements for sending cocktails to go.
So,
so speaking of possibly going back to phase three, which hopefully we will not revert and go backwards like so many other parts of the country are, you know, we've seen, and Alf and I saw that you shared this on Instagram the other day, the block club story of bars in Wrigleyville where people were lined up. From the picture, it looked like it was a lot of people in their 20s. Most were not wearing masks. And I saw a number of people kind of up in arms over this and saying that, like, we have come so far, we've done so well, don't mess it up for the rest of us. So, I mean, what do we do? What's the message? How do we get that word out to people to ensure the safety of the industry?
I just ask my fellow restaurateurs, you know, that we unfortunately need to be the gatekeepers of this business, of the protocols. And I know it's an awkward conversation to force somebody to wear a mask. I mean, I had a young woman that came into the restaurant last week and, you know, we do have a mask requirement. She's like, are you kidding me?
Oh my gosh.
I'm not, you know. So, you know, I said, I don't mind, but my customers do.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? And so you just have to sort of like use your hospitality and use your graciousness. But you also have to keep in mind, you know, as I put on my Instagram, you think it's awkward to talk to your customers about wearing a mask? Try telling the landlord that you don't have rent for this month.
Oh, I know.
Try telling your vendors that you can't pay your bills this month. Yeah. You know, that's a lot more awkward.
Yeah.
And then not to mention, you know, you're endangering your staff. You're endangering, if, you know, one person gets sick, we have to shut down for 2 weeks. Everybody has to quarantine.
Right.
You know, so you kind of have to kind of like think about it that way. And I don't even like using the term selfish because that's not what it is. It's actually in the best interest of everyone. My employees, my fellow restaurateurs, you know, our guests, you know, myself, my family. If I get sick, I expose it to my friends, you know, and so it's the right thing to do. And so I call upon my fellow restaurant owners. Yeah, I know it's awkward. You know, we don't like being the police, but like I said, you have to think about the greater picture of who we're trying to protect here. And so I look at it as this is my duty as a member of the restaurant community to make sure that I do the right things, that we don't go back to phase three.
Right. So I think a good segue to get into the wine conversation is to talk about the passing of Anthony Trelato.
I know, I'm so glad to hear about that.
So for anybody listening, Anthony Trelato, who passed away 2 days ago on the 29th, he was 86 years old, had a long, very full, very successful life. He was the founder of Trelato Wines, which really has made a huge mark on the American wine industry. Tony was the person who discovered Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio and brought it to America in 1979 and really revolutionized American white wine drinking and introduced Pinot Grigio to America and became one of the most successful brands. But he also, I mean, huge importer and distributor of high-end wines. I mean, Alpina, you knew him very well. I mean, you could speak. Did you ever work with them?
No, but he was one of his closest friends in life was Chef Joho. So
okay.
I met Mr. Trelato several times a year. I was very fond of him. I admired him as an entrepreneur, but he was a self-made man also. And I don't think people know the full story about Tony. You know, he was born in Brooklyn, you know, and got into the business at a very early age. So we had a kinship right away. I sat next to him at a luncheon at True's the first time I met him, and Chef Joho told him all about me. And, you know, he said, how did you accomplished so much at such an early age. And, you know, Mr. Terlato was the importer for Alexis Lachine, this big Bordeaux guy, you know, in his 20s. And he became president of Pacific Wine and Spirits, you know, at the age of 29. You know, and I said, well, Mr. Terlato, I should ask the same of you.
Touché.
Like, immediately became friends, you know. And yeah. The thing with Tony was, like, he was just, I wrote, you know, my tribute to him this morning. And, like, he was just a curator of beautiful things. Mm. You know, he had an eye for just the best. I mean, he was uncompromised in his, you know, pursuit of quality and the best. But he loved sharing it with other people, and it made him so happy. I mean, I'm talking like he knew the best pasta sauce and the best olive oil, and I love giving him hugs because he had the softest suits. I mean, I don't know if they were or whatever, but it was just like, Mr. Terlato, you have the softest. It was like cashmere butter. And oh, he's like, wow. Oh, and he would always call me Malpana. And so added the extra M in there. And there's a Taylor. He's in Italy, in Milan. He's the best. I'll give you the name. I'm like, okay.
You're like, so next time I go to Milan.
Right. Like, maybe I can't afford one of those suits, so I'll just hug and pet yours. So this is a really good time to maybe introduce
Alpha. I was just going to say, yeah exactly. You know, we're sitting here chatting with you, and we assume that everybody knows who you are because you are such a big personality. But for those of you listening and you don't know who Alpana Singh is, Alpana grew up in Monterey, California, the daughter of Indian immigrants who emigrated to America from the Fiji Islands to pursue a better life for their children. Her parents wanted her to become a doctor, but the lure of restaurants was stronger than a life in medicine. She entered the wine world working as a clerk in Carmel, California, in a Carmel, California market, and by 23 moved to Chicago to take on the role of sommelier at Everest, one of Chicago's premier restaurants. 3 years later, she earned the title of Master Sommelier, the youngest woman and still the only South Asian to hold that title. Today, 262 people are Master Sommeliers, yet only 27, about 10%, are women. Alpana was the host of TV's Check Please for 10 years and returned to that role in 2018. She has opened 3 restaurants, of which Terra and Vine in Evanston remains, and she played a significant role in bringing the James Baird Foundation Awards to Chicago. Alpana Singh, welcome. Finally, woo! Since we have tried to get you on to Overserved.
Yay! Welcome!
We were supposed to go on for your birthday, remember?
Right,
but it
yeah.
was the middle of the pandemic.
Right, we had scheduled
that. Casual that. Thing.
That darn yeah. pandemic.
Well, we are in the middle of a pandemic. It was during, the quarantine. I'm sorry. Phase 2, I believe that was.
Yeah, it might have even been phase 1. Who even knows? I mean, it was April 13th when we were supposed to do it. And I know that because that is my birthday. But we're super glad to have you here in whatever form, on Zoom or in person. So let's jump in. So you were the world's youngest woman and first woman of color to earn the title of Master Sommelier. What does that mean to you?
You know, it's interesting. When I first set out to become a Master Sommelier, it was more of something that I just needed to do because that was my alternative to going to college. My parents had a business when I was growing up, a grocery store, an Indian grocery store, which is one of the reasons why when I do the show Check Please, I love that we're giving, you know, voice to these small mom and pop businesses because I see so much of my parents in them. So I know what the show does as far as, like, you know, telling these stories. But originally it was just so that I wanted to avoid student debt. And so I figure, okay, if I could pass this test, then I don't have to go to college.
How practical.
Yeah, it's got a 3% pass rate.
Right, it's like not the easiest alternative. Oh my God.
You know, in hindsight, I realized it wasn't such a good plan, but thankfully it worked because I didn't have a backup plan. But also I wasn't really good at college. I mean, I graduated, you know, top 20 in my high school class, but college for me was like, if I'm not interested in it, I can't pursue it. So right. I have to be, like, motivated by a natural curiosity to want to go down that rabbit hole. And so thankfully when it came to wine, I was just fascinated by it and I just couldn't get enough of it. And so, like I said, originally it was just to pursue this thing, but I never thought about, like, what it would mean. And you know, the benefit of being on the side of 40 and you get to have enough life behind you that you start seeing what it meant. And I have to say that it didn't really occur to me what it meant until other people came up to me and told me what it meant to them.
Oh, wow.
You know, that they became, you know, interested in wine because they'd never seen another South Asian woman before. But having seen me, you know, it said, oh, yeah, okay, so there's a place for us, you know. So it was being that sort of emblem of representation in the business, being a minority, being a woman of color. So, yeah, so I'm just grateful that other people were able to, you know, find inspiration in it, you know. And so
do you think if it had occurred to you, and you would have been sort of presented with that pressure of being the first, the only, it just makes me wonder, you know, like that.
I knew that I would be one of the youngest. I knew that.
Yeah.
But I didn't process the, you know, being the first South Asian, being the first woman of color. Like, I didn't process that part.
It's interesting because there's a point where, like, I remember when I was sitting down with Morgan Olson at Time Out when she was looking for a new restaurant critic, and friends had put us together and said, Maggie, you could do this, you know, why don't you guys just meet and talk about it? And oddly enough, I had been interviewed a few months earlier by a woman writing for Cosmo who was wanting to talk to women in their 20s and 30s who had food writing jobs. And it sent me down this rabbit hole of realizing that there were, I mean, at that point, maybe one or two female restaurant critics. And not only that, but, you know, none of them were under the age of 40. And so it was like, I became aware, like, oh, you know, I don't know if I'm qualified for this, but there are no women represented in this role. And then it was a moment of like, oh, I guess I could do it. Like, oh, yeah. Like I can't pass the buck to someone else. This is an opportunity to actually do it myself. I'm going to do it. You know, it's amazing. When you're aware of it, it's really something.
Well, I got to say, you know, the one thing that I can say about myself is it never occurred to me that I couldn't.
Yeah.
And right. The other thing that I always try to like remind people is why not you?
Right.
Exactly.
Right. That's it.
Because isn't that, I mean, I feel
that's
like
so important.
That's such, it seems to be very ingrained in the philosophy of who you are is why not me? And what you were saying even earlier about like, if I'm not interested in college, I can't really focus. And there's so many things that I feel like that you've been incredibly successful because you get interested in that. And like, where does that drive come from? And is that like, has it always been a part of who you are? Or is that like gotten... Like,
my mom would get mad at me because she would give me like, you know, like I was the kind of kid who, if you gave me a Walkman, I would take it apart to see how it worked.
And then you'd have to get another new one.
Yeah, I was always taking things apart at home. You know, I was always like programming the VCR or like, you know, figuring out ways to like trick things up or whatever. But it's always been something, you know. Yeah, I mean, I would always just like, I just can't sit still and I'm eternally curious. But I will say this, you know, when it comes to master sommeliers, you know, you put 50 of us in a room and you're like, this is the most like motley band of people I've ever seen in my life. You know, yeah. There's nothing... You know, like the common thread amongst all of us, because we come from all walks of life, is the fact that we're eternally curious.
Yeah.
The most curious bunch of people ever. Like I've seen my colleagues get into arguments about what's the best way to measure titratable acidity. And they've researched it. I'm just like.
Well, do we need to ask what is titratable acidity? We don't have to go that deep.
Well, that sounds like what happens when you like tweak your knee playing basketball or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh God, the acidity's acting up.
Tritradable acidity.
Did you have something like an early memory of wine that sort of sparked that for you? Was there something about it in particular?
Wine. You know, I will say my dad was a waiter when I was growing up and he kind of liked wine, you know. You know, but here's the sense. I always grew up with, you know, I grew up in Monterey, California, but my parents, we lived in Seaside, which was a little bit more of like the humble part of town, right? And then you had like Carmel, Pebble Beach, et cetera. And you know, growing up in immigrant family, you know, you always had a sense that there's that other side of the peninsula. Mm-hmm. And you always were curious to see like how the other side lived. You know, I remember when family would come to visit and we'd take like the 17-mile drive and I would just like press my face against the window in all these beautiful homes wondering what happened on the other side. You know, and being a child of the 80s, you know, watching shows like Dynasty and
right.
How the rich folk live, you know. But I remember that in the opening sequence of Dynasty, there was that bottle of Dom Perignon that would like burst open. And my dad somehow got a hold of a bottle of Dom Perignon, and it was in the closet, in my parents' closet, in my mom's suitcase that she had brought from Fiji. And I would go and I would visit the bottle.
Wow.
I love this.
It's the same champagne that Alexis carried.
The dynasty bottle. I'm going to pay it a visit.
I think that's amazing that your life in wine, your path to becoming a master sommelier, can be credited back to Alexis Carrington.
Yeah. I just wanted to be Alexis Carrington. I never wanted to be a Crystal because she was weak. I wanted to be, and I think it's from my mother, because even my mother was like, I love that Alexis. Crystal, she's too weak. Alexis Carrington was like this paragon of like the female entrepreneur. She was looking in well before Sheryl Sandberg did.
Yeah, big time.
She was running
leaning in and leaning in and taking you down.
Exactly. Right. Her hats and her, yeah, I'm a big fan of Alexis Carrington. We don't give her, they should teach a course on Alexis Carrington at Harvard Business.
Amen.
Right. Not Joan Collins, but specifically Alexis Carrington. I love it. That's super cool.
So I kind of want to talk about a little bit of your ascent to who you are, getting back to kind of, you know, the restaurant days when, because you mentioned kind of the Monday lunches with Belinda Chang, being a, you know, young women of color. I talked to Belinda about this last year. She talked about the days kind of 20 or so years back. She was at Charlie Trotter's. You were at Everest. You were both kind of repeatedly featured as this like female wine pros to watch and sort of categorize, suggesting that this in and of itself was kind of an anomaly. Can you maybe talk about the impact of being judged on those qualities on your gender first? And
I don't know if Belinda had mentioned this, but we would often get mistaken for each other.
Oh my God, no.
Because you look so much alike.
So similar. Interchangeable, basically.
She's Chinese.
Right.
I think that we both came along at the right time for each other. And the other part, when you do pursue something, you know, like what we did at such an early age, you know, there's a sense of alienation that you don't fit in either. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't like my peers. You know, I remember I would come home from Everest, you know, I lived in Lincoln Park at the time, and there was all these people my age going out to the bars and carrying on and having fun. And I remember one night I was like, I'm going to go out. I'm just going to go, right? And so I went, I got dressed up, and I walked into some like college bar.
Gamekeepers.
And I went in, probably, and then I went into the bathroom, and there was these girls, and I just remember, like, oh my God, I feel so awkward. I feel so weird. And I walk right back out. You know, it was just one of those things. And so there is that sense of just like, you just don't feel like you belong. Like, I remember driving, you know, going down Lakeshore Drive on my way to work, and I saw people playing volleyball, and I'm like, I don't know how to do that. Like, I don't know how to take a Saturday off and play volleyball and be so free and relaxed. You know, and it's still very foreign to me. You know, like, I'll still go down Lakeshore and I see people in, like, paddle boats and, you know, kayaks. I'm like, maybe I could do that one day. But that's just never who I've been. I've always just worked. Mm. And I've always just been very focused. And, yeah, work is my pleasure. And I've been doing it since I was 12 years old. So I really don't know anything else, if that makes sense. So
yeah, that does. She kind of talked about getting to a point where those lists would make her cringe, and it was like, screw this, I want to be in the list with the guys. Like,
what? Yeah, no, it's just like every 5 or 6 years they discover that there's female sommeliers, and you'll get in a roundup, or for, you know, Asian American Heritage Month, you know, the top Asians in the country, and then they forget about you for the, you know, 10 months.
That sounds like Black History Month.
Oh, God.
I'm like, hey, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
125,000 black people changing the way that we breathe. And it's like,
let's list them all
now. Let's list them all now.
Right now.
Also, whoever had to put those lists together, like, shout out to that intern, because, you know, they had to do the work.
Invite for a women's panel. You know, like, oh, would you like to be on a women's panel? I'm like, no, I'd like to be like on a regular panel. You know,
on a women's panel. Oh, God.
A panel for ladies.
Right.
So, do you think, though, that, you know, especially now at this time where there is so much, I guess, for lack of a better word, upheaval and awareness and change happening, like, do you see you know, like you look at the world's 50 best restaurant list. And then when a couple years ago, when they added like the best female chef, like when there wasn't a single restaurant helmed by a woman for so many years on that list, like, do you see this us moving in a direction where it isn't going to be like the best women in wine or the best people of color in wine? I mean, it's not to say that people don't deserve to be shouted out, but like, why not make a collective list of all people? Like, do you see us moving in a direction like that?
The thing, you know, I think what we are experiencing in our country is sort of this, I call it a cold civil war, not necessarily between political divides, but generational divides.
Yeah.
You know, and even with myself, sometimes the world just seems to be moving so fast, and I consider myself fairly liberal and up to speed, and I don't want to use the term woke, but you know, like, and I listen to my partner's 17-year-old daughter sometimes, I'm like, what? You know, like Gen Z is not messing around. Yeah. I mean, you know, Phoebe was born right after 9/11. So she was born in this like society where there was like a terror rating. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of competitive pressure. And then you had the financial crisis and now you have the pandemic. And, you know, you just think about the environment that these young people have come up in, and they've got Bernie and trying to do the right thing. And, you know, they're going to take us to task and they're going to call us out. And I think the big difference of what's happening right now is the call out culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are being called out. I mean, even just for the slightest thing, you know, that happened maybe 10 years ago and you thought at the time it was fine, and people are now having to step away from their companies. Yeah. You know, is that right? Is that wrong? I don't know. But I will say that it is evocative of this generation that's coming up that are not going to be okay with walking into a panel where there's all white men.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
I'm gonna call them out.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's something that I think with the Court of Master Sommeliers is that, you know, we have this ideology that is driven, maybe that worked 30 years ago for a certain type of sommelier. But are we adjusting how we teach, what we teach, who we teach to, our outreach program, et cetera, to fit the sommelier of tomorrow?
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think that that's very important because at the end of the day, we're an organization that provides this accreditation, you know, education, et cetera, but we have to know who we're teaching to and the person that's walking into that room because they're not like us. You know,
right.
Different set of demands, and they aren't as tolerant with injustice.
Can you?
And I think that's fabulous.
Yeah. Can you speak to kind of maybe a bit of this coming, you know, getting to that point? Wine is you know, somewhat rooted in Europe and kind of these white adjacencies and, you know, products of these colonial and imperialist histories. It's like this sort of steeped in this coded language and techniques that historically more privileged rich people have had access to.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned Alexis Carrington, right?
Yeah,
that right.
Impression of that it's for the Alexis Carringtons of
exactly.
World.
So where do we start?
It occurred to us that, you know, or it's not represented to us or reflected back to us that anybody can take part in it. Mm. You know, but the interesting thing about wine is that who falls in love with it is completely colorblind.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, the infrastructure of who gets to enjoy, who gets to participate, you know, the messages that we receive and who gets to participate is highly biased.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the language of wine is biased.
Yes.
You know, the way that we describe it is, you know, based in this Eurocentric language, you know, and then somebody like me who grew up in a South Asian kitchen, you know, I had to fit to the mold rather than the mold fitting to me. But, you know, when you look at wine from just a biological perspective and how our sense of smell works, we describe things based on our own scent memory and our own scent bank. It's kind of like the movie Pixar Inside Out, right? When we smell something, we go to our bank of marbles.
Yeah.
Right? So if you've never had a gooseberry, if you've never had a currant, if you've never like experienced
totally.
You know, or grandpa's tobacco pipe.
Or licked leather or a number two pencil.
Or river stones.
But so somebody, gooseberry could be somebody else's jalapeno.
Mm.
Right.
You know, and I discovered this when I was actually teaching wine classes for Lettuce when I was the director of wine and spirits and, you know, predominantly Latinx, service team. And I would use these descriptions. They're looking at me like, what are you talking about? Asking them to relate to something that they've never experienced, you know, but they don't want to say anything because they like, okay, well, this is just must be what it is. And I'm just not sophisticated or experienced. But then I started adjusting my descriptions to fit foods that they could have grown up with. And it's like a light bulb went off.
Wow.
That's so genius that you were able to hone in on that. And that probably had to do with the fact that you grew up eating food in a South Asian kitchen, you know, versus, you know, eating gooseberries. So like that, it's cool that that light bulb went off. I mean, so do you come at it? I mean, also like, well, wine is a, you know, you mentioned how there were things that people weren't understanding and weren't clicking with, but I think that's also for the general population.
Yes,
you know,
that's me.
So many
Me too. Yeah. Hi.
But like so many times, you know, people, and I mean, and like I've been writing about wine and studying wine, you know, not intimately like you have for a number of years, but I mean, my palate is still very, I feel young, but I'll talk to my friends who are intimidated to talk about wine because they don't know what to say or they think that they're going to say the wrong thing. And to your point, it knows no color. It has no boundaries and it's what you take from it. Right.
It's what you, it basically it's understanding that when you pick up a glass of wine and you smell it, that you're accessing your own memories. And so for you, if it smells like Barbie dolls or if it smells like cumin, coriander, cloves or whatever it is, then say it because that's your memory trigger.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to basically say that, oh, no, these are the set of smells based on this very sort of white Eurocentric, you know, descriptions when, I mean, I didn't even see a gooseberry until I was 21 years old. I walked, I was like, that's a gooseberry? You know, but I'm using the description for 3 years.
Yeah. Mm. You
know? And then I finally taste it. I'm like, ah, yeah, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. I get it now.
Yeah, totally.
Honest to God, if you were just like, hey, what's a gooseberry right now? You could probably hand me like a crunch berry and I would have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, same.
I would love to describe a flavor of wine as a crunch berry.
Yeah.
It's probably out there somewhere.
For sure. You know, or a Cap'n Crunch marshmallow. Or a Lucky Charms marshmallow, rather.
You know, Ari, it's just when you intimidation can come in so many forms. It's like being embarrassed about what you like, you know, because you buy it at the 7-Eleven or Trader Joe's. I can't tell you how many times people like apologize to me for what they love. I'm like, why are you apologizing?
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm glad
the first time. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Go on.
Like price point wise, you know, whether they like sweet wine, dry wine, this, that, whatever, but we need to stop apologizing for the things that we enjoy.
Right.
Right.
Do you know what's been helpful for me just to thinking about kind of what should taste like what? Honestly, drinking natural wine has been really helpful for that because a lot of times the grape doesn't come with this set of characteristics that, you know, you traditionally associate it with. I was at Outside Voices, the wine bar in Logan Square a few months ago, pre these times.
I like that you pointed behind you.
Oh yeah, it's right over there. Yeah. That's actually true. But I was there and tasting, I think it was technically made from Cabernet grapes and the bartender told me, you know, I had a guy come in and yell at me, like, how dare you call this? It's not what it tastes like. And he said, but that doesn't matter. Like it with this kind of, you know, so it was very freeing to drink wine and not feel like it adhered to these classification tables that I don't understand. Then it kind of frees you up to just go, oh, I like this. It tastes like this or, you know, and I don't know. It feels to me like that little budding area of wine is tearing down some of those preconceptions in some ways.
I mean, really, it's just the correct way to drink wine is basically like you do you.
Yeah.
You know, like if you get Cabernet out of it, you get Cabernet out of it. And the fact that this person came over here and is trying to tell you that, no, what you are experiencing and feeling and sensing is wrong.
Right.
It's like so weird.
It's right? So weird. Why do you right. care what I experience yeah, also?
Like you stick to you, you do you, I'll do me, and then we'll all get along. And
right. Right. Totally.
So true.
So you talked about when you were doing the trainings at Lettuce that people looked at you with confusion and not understanding and that, you know, and the history of wine is that we were just saying is deeply rooted in Europe. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, what the wine world looks like for people of color. You know, just like last week, writer Janae Gaither wrote an essay, a really great essay on VinePair, on the website on VinePair, recently about her experience about being Black and working in wine country tasting rooms. And then similarly, this week, wine writer Eric Asimov in the New York Times had an article titled Black Wine Professionals Demand to Be Seen. And it showcased nine people from writers like Julia Coney and Tammy Teclamarium, to restaurant professionals like Zwan Grays, to Andre Houston Mack, who was the head sommelier at Per Se, and now has his own winery, Maison Noir. And every single one of them talked about racism, not being seen, being talked down to by patrons. And the comments that I read online by so many people were like disgusting and basically saying like, just get over it. And I mean, obviously this is just wrong on so many levels. So like how does wine culture change to your point of saying that wine is colorblind and wine shouldn't know boundaries, but then how do we get that point across to people who, you know, one of the things that Janae said in her essay in VinePair was that she was telling a patron that she collects champagne, vintage champagne. And the woman who happened to be white said, well, do you mean sparkling wine? As if to say that she can't afford good vintage champagne.
Oh, that's an expensive hobby, like putting it in those terms. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really. And here's the problem. I mean, this is the cost of what happens when you don't have representation.
Right.
You know, because there are three things that the wine industry needs. You know, we need to give access to people who normally don't have access. And I'm talking about being invited to trade tastings, being invited on wine trips, you know, access to wine in general. Like one of the big struggles when you're coming up in the wine biz is, you know, buying these wines.
Oh, and totally.
Tastings, you know, especially when things like Burgundy and Bordeaux and what have you. You know, and so and that's why we chummy up to collectors and distributors and, you know, what have you, because we need to have access to the wines to be able to experience them. You know, and the next thing is opportunity and opportunity with the jobs and the positions of being a sommelier or a winemaker or running a tasting room, you know, even management. And this is something where, you know, we in the business need to look at our staff. And are we doing the best job possible in tapping the people and giving them those opportunities, you know, and saying, you're next, you know, here, go to this wine tasting, or like, here, take this class, or here's a wine book. And, you know, because everybody is valuable and everybody has potential if they're interested, you know. And then, you know, the last one is representation. And I do believe that that is the most important. And it's quoting people in articles, putting them on panels. You know, I mean, you look at something like Food & Wine Magazine in Aspen, and Ari, I don't know if you've ever been, but, you know,
no.
30 Me of neither. The panels are white men, and they're qualified, don't get me wrong, and you learn a lot, it's great, but what message does that send the audience as far as who can be the gatekeepers of information?
You know,
and it would mean the world if somebody like a Julia Coney was on the panel, because then that tells the audience that, yes, Black people matter, too, when it comes to wine.
Yeah,
you know,
that that Black people know about wine,
and Black people
not
know
just,
about
it's not just white guys.
That's the biggest, I would say, misconception as a Black person kind of existing in this world a little bit, is I walk in and the natural assumption, and this is a key lesson for anybody who happens to be owning a wine shop or sells wine at their organization. Don't assume I don't know what I'm talking about. Don't assume I can't afford what I'm talking about.
Oh my God.
Right? Or it's sometimes the bigotry of low expectations, where you walk in and it's just like, have you had wine before?
Oh, God, stop.
Yeah, it's happened a lot of times at a lot of places, and to the point where I can say with confidence that it has dissuaded me from going to a wine shop and asking questions. Like, I put my head down, I get my stuff, and I get out. And I shouldn't have to feel that way. You know what
it's
I'm saying?
It's infuriating. Totally. Yep. And here's the other thing is, like, it's dumb business.
Yep. Yes. You know?
It's dumb business. It's sort of like this person is coming to you. They want to participate. They want to spend money.
This is a customer.
You know, they want to like spend money.
And it's the quickest way to ensure that I don't spend money with your organization, your space, is to be like, oh, you don't treat me as a fully developed human being.
That's fucking insane.
If you take that person's money, then you have to treat them with respect and dignity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just what it is. It's like, you can't exploit the consumer either, you know, like, oh, you know, like, I mean, it has to come. And this is the shocking thing about the wine business is, Like, we're leaving so much money on the table by ignoring South Asian drinkers, black drinkers, you know.
I feel like that's every industry. It's like, you know? If you really yeah. love money as much as you say you do, why are you leaving so much on the table?
You know, right. I mean, I remember when I was working at Everest, you know, I walk up to a table and, you know, it was always the women too, which is so surprising to me. But on more than one occasion, like, wow, you know, I thought maybe they read some article about me or something. So I was like, okay. She goes, I didn't even know they made wine in India.
Oh my God.
Reddit, honey, where do you come from? She's like, no, where do you really come from? Like, Monterey.
Yeah.
I'm not playing this game, you know?
No.
But no, I mean, I think to your point of what can the industry do that we as, if we're going to be proper allies and if we want to like create change, then we have to stand up, you know, and basically say, okay, yeah, I'll come join your panel. Who else is on the panel?
Right. We're like,
yeah, I'll take that wine trip. Who else have you invited?
Yeah.
And if you don't see a person of color, if you don't see them giving opportunity and proper access, then you say no and you call them out on it. And that's just how we change.
Well, that's how you'd sent me that article a couple of weeks ago about Richard Betts, also a master sommelier. He's also the founder of, what is it, Sombra Mezcal?
The Sombra Mezcal. He's about to launch. He's like an internal entrepreneur. I mean,
yeah.
Richard's an extremely 30, fascinating man.
30-something white guy wrote a Medium post. Basically, he was stepping down from the master court of sommeliers because of inequity. Inequality, lack of diversity. And so it's like, I think it was really a big deal that somebody with such a big platform was being an even bigger ally by saying, I'm not going to be a part of this because you're doing it wrong. Mm. And you're refusing to change.
Test at the same time. And, you know, we've been friends for, oh my gosh, almost 20 years. And I'm not surprised that nobody's ever resigned from the court. And I'm actually not surprised that it was Richard, because that's just who he is. You know, I remember the first time we proctored an exam together was here in Chicago, and there was a sommelier by the name of Yannick Benjamin. And Yannick was in a car accident about a year before, and he was in a wheelchair. He was paralyzed from the waist down. And Yannick is an extremely interesting person, fascinating, inspiring. You know, he continues to do his sommelier work from a wheelchair.
Right. You know,
I mean, he's amazing. And so there was some like controversy with the exam now, because they weren't sure how to examine him, you know, given the wheelchair situation. And there was even talk about, oh, we can't examine him. And this was at a time when we were working with our British counterparts. And I remember somebody saying, yeah, I don't know how it works over there, but we have something called ADA. Stood up and went like, this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. We cannot deny him the right to test. And he was so vocal, you know, as was I, but I just remember that, like, he was just so like inflamed by the idea that this person was not going to be able to get a fair exam or even examined, you know, because of, you know, being you know. But that's just who Richard is.
So I'm kind of curious about, from the perspective of being someone who has say in winemaker representation on menus, how do you, what are your views on kind of the idea of representation for representation's sake in that sense? There are, you know, not a lot of black owned wineries in the United States, for example, wines made by women, LGBTQ folks, because a lot of the just histories and who inherits houses. And so, I mean, when you're balancing kind of with competing elements, quality, style, price point, food pairing, how do you approach that piece of it? And do you vocalize that?
I think intention is everything. If you're just doing it to get some brownie points and to look woke, well, then that doesn't make sense. You know, nobody a service. But I think if your intention really is, you know, at the end of the day, what we as sommeliers do is we're storytellers and we share stories. And, you know, that's a great part of the wine experience. You know, long gone are the days where you just pour somebody a glass of something and then that's it. You know, people want to know who made this, where did it come from? What's the history of the grape variety? What's the winemaker? You know, like, they want to know the People magazine aspect of the wine.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that telling these stories are, you know, it's extremely important, not only because of what it represents, But also just for the consumer experience as well. And so I was thinking about, you know, as I'm filling my shelves at the wine shop, you know, how I'm going to curate these stories and tell these stories, because people really want to know, you know, what's going on. But I think that representation begets representation, and the more interest that we take and the more we demand from wineries, you know, that there is, you know, more diversity, then hopefully the hiring practices will change. You know, it's not a top-down approach, unfortunately, it's a bottom-up approach to creating that change.
Yeah.
I mean, look at something like rosé, right? It's not like the wine industry is like, hey, we're going to market rosé. Yeah. Happened with, you know, a bunch of millennials on Instagram, you know, photographing their pink glasses going, yes way, rosé.
Oh, all day, all day. Oh, can you even, you know, but it's interesting with rosé. I was just on I did like a tasting of Illinois rosé a few weeks ago from their Wine Growers Association, and they got together a bunch of winemakers and said, okay, all over the state, we have very different climate, different geography, but one thing that we can all make fairly successfully with the grapes that we grow in Illinois is rosé. So it became a challenge, and it's like, let's all get together, let's uplift the perception of Illinois-made wine by, like, everyone make the best rosé you can, and we'll just get a bunch of people. And the cool thing they do is, they open it up to, like, if you're on a CVB board, like a convention visitors bureau board, they say, okay, taste. And so they really sort of democratize who's tasting it and getting responses at these focus groups. So it was a cool,
how were
like,
they
were good. There's Illinois Sparkling is making, they're making.
He's
just fantastic. I mean, he's a true pioneer and indefatigable. That's
and you know, when you said, when you mentioned the sort of common thread being curiosity, I think that's the case with wine. I mean, that guy is boundlessly curious too, and wanting to tinker. And so it was such fun, and it made me think about Illinois wine in a different way. And,
you know, you use the term democracy, right? It democratizes it. And the thing about supporting Illinois wineries is, you know, not everybody has the means to get on an airplane and go to Napa Valley and
take
a 2-hour car, rent a car, go to Napa, spend $400 on a hotel room and spend $50, you know, pop in a tasting room. You know, it's a costly thing. But to drive to Utica, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spend an hour and a half, spend the day tasting, maybe stay at a B&B or something, you know, eat at the Cajun Corner, whatever the restaurant is. But you can do that. You know, you can drive out to Westmont, there's that Aqua Viva winery, you can go to Galena, you know, and I think who does a good job with this is Cooper's Hawk.
Mm-hmm. They do.
Democratize wine and to embrace a consumer that has long been ignored.
Yes.
And it shows as far as, I mean, they just sold the company for $700 million, you know, and if that doesn't wake up the wine industry, I don't know what will. So this is a company who has based their business model on going into these peripheral areas that people just kind of don't consider of like, oh yeah, they're not going to drink wine. Well, guess what they do?
Guess
what?
They're spending
a lot of money, and it's the number one wine club in the United States.
Really?
Wow. And this could be you, but you're racist, boo.
Totally. Oh my God.
You need to make that a t-shirt right now.
It could be just
a bunch of people of color with just like bands and just tons of money in their hands. Like, this could be you if you weren't racist. Just making it rain.
Well, Jay-Z did that.
Yeah. But I mean, we need a remix. It's time. Elvin, it's time to start rapping is what I'm saying.
I do feel like such a way to let people in is humor. I was reading this piece on this profile on you, because, like, let's face it, if you look up Alpinising, you can read a million profile pieces like in an hour. There's so many on you. But I love this one. It was from 750 Daily. And I think it was Lettuce's wine director, Seth Wilson, trained with you. And you talked about how you would hold up your leg as like a comparison to a map of Italy.
Like, I think that's so funny.
I know. Do you feel like, it seems to me like humor is such a great way to sort of break
it disarms,
down.
It
totally.
People. And, you know, when I teach wine classes, and, you know, it's interesting, especially something like the boarding house, where pretty much everybody who worked at the boarding house on that opening team now runs a wine program or owns a restaurant.
Mm.
Is a director of operations somewhere. Like, you know,
amazing.
You know, so we're very proud of that opening team, because it just really sparked a lot of wine interest in that like I said, that opening crew.
Yeah.
You know, but I think really what I did was I would tell these stories, but what happens is when you tell a funny story, it makes it sticky and people remember it.
Yeah.
You know, like people don't remember the fact that a wine was barrel fermented for 18 months. Like
what? I always do.
Yeah. But you also
like Britney Spears, you know.
but you also make wine less intimidating for people. And I remember, you know, the first time when you and I first met and you had a small dinner party, like, I don't know, 10 or so years ago.
When did you, so you guys met 10 years, tell us please. Paint a picture, Ari, please paint a picture.
I actually don't remember how we met. Do you?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I know that my ex-husband's Jewish and I know you guys bonded over.
I think it might've been through Charles actually.
Mm.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I felt like I was like, oh my God, I'm going to Alpana Singh's house for dinner. I have to bring a really expensive bottle of wine to impress her, whatever. And I remember, I will never forget this. I gave you the wine. I couldn't tell you today what it was. But you looked at it and you go, ooh, expensive. And immediately like broke it down and like you made me like instantly realize, oh, she's a master sommelier, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be
fancy.
The biggest, most expensive, fancy bottle of wine. Like you could still have a great bottle of wine for $12, you know? And so, but you do like, you have that ability. And I think that's why people gravitate to you. I mean, is that just part of your DNA or is that something that you set out to do to make things easier to?
And you know, you know, I am my mother's daughter. If there's a less expensive way to do something, still like, you know, have as much fun doing it, I will find out. But no, that is actually, truth be told, that has become a lot of my brand of like, I want nice things, but I just don't want to pay full freight for it. And if I can find like a way to spend less money, because we work hard for our money.
Yeah.
We really do. And now, don't get me wrong, like once in a while, like I'll splurge and this and that, whatever. But you know, if you can find, like I said, a less expensive way to have as much joy, why not?
Don't you feel like that's more exciting too? Like that's like you have to do the work to uncover like where the value is, or it's kind of fun.
You don't have to be a wine expert to go buy a $100 bottle of wine.
Right, exactly.
Right.
It's going to be good. Hopefully it's good. But you kind of need to know what you're doing if you want to get something that's really tasty and like a find at $15. You really do have to know what you're doing. And so, but like you say, that is a lot more exciting, you know? I mean, that's like, ooh, okay. You know, and I do that with everything, with my recipes, with my life hacks or this or that, whatever. It's trying to give you the good life, but like at half the price.
Yes. Right. That's really
like,
living.
Like when people ask me about, you know, getting or how do I get into wine? How do I learn about wine? And I tell them this because this is what I did when it was still called Wine Discount Center. And now it's been Chicago. It is one of, in my opinion, the best places to get introduced to wines, because if you walk around the periphery of their shop, it mostly is wine under $20 and it's from around the world. And if you can go and you can spend $100 to $120 and you can get, you know, 8 to 12 bottles of wine and you can experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's such a, you know, great opportunity for people to get into wine, to dip their toe into like, I like this, I don't like this, or that was a weird one. Oh, wow, this is a great find. So do you have, what are your recommendations for people other than reading your top 10 lists and reading your blog, but like, what are your recommendations for people? And do you have favorite wine shops around town that you think people can?
You hit the nail on the head, is to find a great wine shop, mm-hmm. you know, and to keep going back and hopefully dealing with the same one or two people. They get to know your palate. You know, it's like having a personal shopper at a department store or something. They know your size, they know which brands you like, they know your cut, color, et cetera. You know, but having that ability to go like, I got a guy or I got a gal, you know, is really awesome. So my wine shop of choice is, I love Perman Wines.
Mm. Yeah.
I love them, but Vin Chicago is really good too. You know, and Vinny's really does a great job also.
I agree.
But really it's about finding that person.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Developing that relationship, and they will take amazing care of you. And if you don't have that person, you know, a lot of us have a favorite restaurant, you know, and maybe there's that server or the sommelier or the owner of a restaurant that can introduce you to some things too. But like I said, these are all just, again, it's about access points, right? It's access. And, you know, I try to put myself in the place whenever I come up with my list, you know, if I didn't know anything about wine and I walked into Mariano's, what would I do besides walk right back out? the prettiest label, hard. But what you do is you rely on the recommendation of another person. And then the thing with wine is if the person sitting to the left of you can say five more things about the wine, then all of a sudden they're an expert in your eyes. And so you just have to trust that you can be that person for yourself too. And you're not going to, here's the other fallacy. You're not going to like everything. I don't know why everyone has this expectation that every bottle you pick up is going to be this mind-blowing experience. I've had some really awful wines in my life, you know? but that's just part of the game. You win some, you lose some, you know, and you're not going to enjoy everything you pick up.
Yeah. True. I think people get jealous, though, because there's a lot of times when you talk to a wine person, they go, oh, I'll never forget when I drank the 1967 blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh my God, they have this exact memory of what it looked like and smelled like and where they were sitting. And I want that. I need that because that will be when it clicks and everything starts to make sense. How come I haven't had that yet? I don't remember even what a label looks like.
You got to be smart in the jerk. When he became rich all of a sudden, he went to that restaurant and they brought him this 1967. He's like, what is this old wine?
The cheat code I have, because the problem with drinking a lot of wine is that you don't remember things sometimes.
Yes.
I take a picture.
I have so many blurry pictures of wine bottles.
Oh yeah, for sure. They're definitely blurry, but then you get the fun puzzle of what does this say?
I have friends who are obsessed with the Vivino app. Obsessed. My friend Wayne, whenever we got to dinner, he's like, what's it up on Vivino? And he just right? And, you know, I mean, this is going to be kind of a game-changing app, particularly in retail, because it aggregates the average price across the United States. And you could be in a restaurant and you're like, wow, why are they charging me $140 for this? Besides,
I
rent my employees and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, okay, so this is only supposed to be $35, you know, so,
Ooh, interesting.
The markup, the perpetual debate in all restaurants.
That bothers me so much, when I know a bottle costs, $15 at retail, and they're charging me $60 at the restaurant. I was like, really?
Now that should, you know, at the most, they should charge $45 for that.
Totally.
That's a great
you are a mentor, obviously, to young wine professionals, but also to a lot of consumers. Who were your mentors growing up? What was the impact that they had on you?
Well, I would say the most significant mentor I've ever had was Chef Joho. And my time with him, 5 years, you know, when I first moved to Chicago, I mean, I was this 23-year-old soft thing from California, you know? And I mean, I had a fire, don't get me wrong, but he really sharpened my edge.
will you tell us about bit about him and about Everest?
Sure. So Chef Joho is from Alsace. He actually started off his career very young too. He moved to Chicago to take over Everest. God, I think he was 26, 27 years old. I mean, he was a phenom.
Wow.
And he knows a lot about wine, has impeccable taste, but he's hard. God, he was so hard on me. And I mean, every day I would go to work and it was just like, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Whiplash with, the drummer movie, you know?
Totally. Yeah.
So it was kind of like that, you know, every day it was just like, it would just torture me, you know, it was just you know, and I would do something and he would mark it up. He's like, go back and do it again. I'm just like, what? You know, but I didn't realize at the time, it wasn't until it was right after I'd opened Boarding House. And it was like that Mr. Miyagi moment when you realize,
why?
I know how to do this. You know, but he would take me out. I remember when I was nominated for a Beard Award for wine service. And he's like, okay, we go to New York. And then we land in New York. And he was never somebody who would go out of his way to make you feel good.
Comfortable. So make sure you're comfy and okay.
It was a lot of tough love. And but he says, okay, we're gonna go have lunch. And then we walked into La Bernadette. And that was my first meal ever in New York, was at La Bernadette.
Oh my God.
Wow.
He would do stuff like that. Like he took me to Alsace and like, I mean, it was just incredible. And you know, but I just realized now, like right after I'd opened Boarding House, I went to him and I said, you know, I used to think, why are you doing this to me? And I want to ask, why did you do this for me?
Mm. Wow.
And it was actually 2 years ago. It was at the Everest, like 30th anniversary. He comes up to me and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he's like, you know, I'm so proud of you. And he goes, yes, I was very, very hard on you, but I knew you could take it. I knew you could.
It's interesting because we're kind of dealing with this reckoning, you know, in the restaurant industry and other industries. And I think some of it is sort of tied into that old model of sort of the French brigade kitchen and that sort of tough love and having a bunch of misfits coming in. It also breeds, and the high stress breeds, on the other hand, abuse, like potential for abuse. So now we're kind of... There's a
huge difference between tough love
and
abuse.
Yeah.
So he never sexually abused me. You know, it was never sexual harassment. He never used names or derogatory terms. Like I was never in fear. You know, it was just more like the work was not good enough or up to the standards that he knew I was capable of.
Mm.
There's a big difference between that. You know, it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Yeah.
And he said it in a way that was always very respectful. And I never felt like I used the word torture, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't, that, you know, like you're incompetent or anything like that. Like the language he used was never demeaning or emotionally or mentally abusive.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, I always came back wanting to do better. And but the most important thing is like, I wanted to come back and prove myself.
Yeah.
You know? So Alpen, I have a question really quick, because I think one of the things that I've heard from other like Black chefs or people who want to be Black chefs is like, there's a bit of a cultural divide in that, like the culture I feel of restaurants is that very much like, we're going to grind you until you get it right. And it feels like there's definitely a lack of folks like your mentor who are going to say, no, I'm holding you to a higher standard.
Yes.
And the culture of abuse is just the culture of abuse.
That's
and
right.
I know for one, a lot of people are saying like, I understand I'm trying to get better, but you're not going to talk to me that kind of way. So How do, I guess, like these chefs who idolize these like hardcore, like that culture of being kind of an asshole, like how does that change? Because I think that might be one of the reasons why you're not seeing a lot more chefs or people in that industry.
You know, I think, that's a difficult question because I can't speak for how do we get other people to not be abusive jerks.
How not to be an asshole, yeah.
Right.
Just lead by example.
Yeah.
You know, just be the example that you want to see. And really, it's this nuanced approach where, yes, there is a higher standard, but there was also those moments of softness, you know, and it's showing that softer side. And I think intention is everything. And I don't believe that Joho was ever driven by ego. It was driven by his love of me. You know, he was very much like a father figure. He continues to be a father figure, but, you know, I think there's just sort of that, like I said, it's just, I got very lucky, but it also scares me that I also got very
lucky. Yes, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it could have gone the other way.
Yeah. Well, and I think we talked about this a little at the beginning, but like the pandemic has sort of forced us to reexamine a lot of these things that were already going on for so long, because we kind of have to stop and take a breath. And I think the protests as well against police brutality, it's triggering certain people to kind of recognize that maybe their own situation isn't a healthy one. And I think what's tough about restaurants is it's high stress. It's low, you know, it's tight profit margins. It's
low pay,
Barrier to entry. So people can work their way up, and it brings, it's a sort of equal opportunity in that sense that, you know, anyone can kind of work their way up pretty much.
I'm not gonna lie, like I've lost it a few times, you know, and I remember, especially when Boarding House first opened, I didn't think I could cuss that way.
You don't strike me as a cusser.
Oh man. Oh my God. Like I didn't even know, because the stress and the pressure and your name is on the line and all of that.
Yep.
You know, but I will say this, and in the times where I have lost my temper, And I have to do a lot of work on myself. Don't get me wrong. Like, I go to therapy, I meditate, I work out, like, yeah. I take time for myself, because it does get very frustrating. And you can only learn this by being very self-aware, I guess. But I will say this, the times where I have lost it and I have, you know, gone off on an employee, I've immediately regretted it. And it has always forever changed the relationship. Like, it just changes, and you can't put the toothpaste back into the bot, you know, like, you just can't. It just changes it. And there's never been an occasion where I've lost it and I went, yeah, okay, that was warranted.
Yeah.
You know, like, it just doesn't work. Mm. It really doesn't, you know, and it's just kind of like with parenting. You know, I'm not a parent, but, you know, like, I can yell at you and scream at you and make you do something, or we can make it where you know that I would be extremely disappointed if you did a bad job.
Mm. Right.
You know, and I think really that's kind of the worst things I could ever say to my employees, is in a very common voice to say, I'm so disappointed in you.
That's so much worse.
Oh, that hurts. Hearing it as a hypothetical. Like, but oh no, don't say it.
It's so much more impactful when somebody that you respect or look up to mm-hmm. comes up to you and doesn't yell at you and beat you down, but says simply, I'm disappointed in you, mm-hmm. and walks away.
Well, it also implies that they hold you to a standard. Like,
right.
What it comes down to is there's a standard.
Right.
You know, and you know, I mean, so I don't know. Like I said, like, I've lost it. I've yelled, I've screamed, but like I said, it just doesn't work. It does not work.
How do you feel that this time of sort of being forced to slow down, when you're able to, like, in regular times, to kind of just stay on that hamster wheel of day-to-day service in the restaurant and things like that, this pandemic that sort of forced us to take some time, how have you reflected on this, and how do you kind of hope to see the future of your business and just kind of the restaurant industry as we're kind of grappling with some of this huge stuff in this time?
You know, I will say that the word that comes to my mind is gratitude. Mm. And the reason for this is because this is the longest I've ever not been in a restaurant. 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah. The quarantine that we just came from. And the reason why I use the term gratitude is because our bills are paid up. You know, we have a very understanding landlord. We got the PPP money. Mm. My staff is doing okay. So all things considered, everybody's okay right now, at least I can tell. Mm-hmm. And I know that a lot of my fellow restaurant owners are not in that position. So I say this knowing that not everybody's in the same situation that I am in. And that makes me hurt, because like I said, I know what it's like to have two restaurants close, and it's the worst feeling in the world. The sense of failure and just like, I mean, it's a depression. I mean, it really is. And my heart breaks. And so I'm just so grateful that I don't have to go through that again right now, mm-hmm. you know? And so taking that time to really think about what's working, what's not working, what can go, where can we pivot, looking at the landscape in the next 12 to 18 months, where the opportunities are. And I'm so grateful that I have that runway to look at the opportunities ahead.
Yeah.
And not everybody's in that position, and it sucks.
Yeah.
It is. It's a harsh reality that, I mean, that they're saying, you know, and to Maggie's timeline of the next 12 to 18 months or 18 to 24 months, you know, that 1,500 restaurants potentially out of 7,500 in Chicago alone mm-hmm. could close.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a harsh reality, and to hear that you are on a good path is reassuring. And to see what so many people have done to pivot their businesses, you know, from the three Michelin star to Linea down to, you know, Vincent's in Andersonville, where they're, you know, with meal kits and takeout and selling wine and whatnot. So I think that there is hope, you know, there is, there's not a light at the end of the tunnel yet, but I think that people are making the most of it, and they're working their way through the storm.
The restaurant community is the most resilient I've ever seen in my life. You know, and I'm extremely proud to be a part of this community, to be considered a member of just these amazing men and women that, despite everything that's happening, you know, is soldiering forward. Mm-hmm. You know, except for the bar owners in Texas who said that bar lives matter. They don't count.
Oh my God.
Everybody except those people.
Except them.
So I think this is a good time to go into the next segment, mm-hmm. Short Order, which is our quick fire round. We're going to ask you a series of questions. You answer with what comes to your mind first.
No wrong answers.
No wrong answers at all. So what would you be doing if you were not a master sommelier and restaurateur?
Chef. Yeah.
What kind of follow-up question, not in the list, what kind of food would you want to cook?
Probably some type of, just like American fusion, you know, new American. Yeah, but I would love to be a chef. My dad was a chef, so I'm actually shocked, considering my love of food, that I ended on the dining room side and not the kitchen side.
Oh, interesting.
It's actually kind of interesting, but I actually thought about, you know, in that transition mode when Boarding House closed and Seven Lions closed, and I was trying to think about what I wanted to do with my life. And I actually talked to Kevin Bame about it. And I said, can I just come stage in your kitchens for like a week or something? Like, sure, come on over.
And did you?
Yeah. No, I didn't. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't have the ankles for restaurant work anymore.
I hear that. Right. I hear that.
Okay. Next question. Who is your hero?
My hero. Oh, gosh. God, I don't, you know, actually, I know who my hero is. It's my friend, Chili Pepper. She's you know, she's a survivor. There's not a situation that woman has been through where she has not shown grace, overcoming adversity to situations. And she's just always been there for me to remind me, Mary, could always be worse.
Yeah. Yeah, love that.
True.
A little less intense. What did you have for breakfast today?
I have not had breakfast yet. I worked out, so I have not had breakfast yet.
Good for you. Any caffeine or any?
Oh, yeah, I had coffee. Okay. I've been out of milk for like 3 days, but I don't want to walk outside because it's too schmitzy. So I've been extending this can of evaporated milk.
Oh, my God.
I feel that.
Are awful. Like if you look at our refrigerator, it's like bare bones embarrassing.
Okay, what movie will you always watch if you stumble on it while flipping through channels?
Pretty Woman.
That's mine. I love good that.
Because remember we talked about you hated the musical.
I hated the musical. Terrible.
Oh my God.
Okay, if you have one, what is your life motto?
Never a dull moment.
Good. What song will always make you stop whatever you're doing and dance or bop your head?
Oh, that's easy. It's Not the Lonely One by Bonnie Raitt.
Bonnie Raitt. Wow. All right.
That's my favorite song. Yeah.
What is your last request meal? No limitations. And because you're up in a sing, what are you drinking with it?
Oh, God. Yes. Well, champagne. Might as well go out with the bang.
That's right. Go out with the Dom that you used to spend time with as a child in the closet.
Way to pull it back around, Maggie.
I did it.
You know, it's so funny because it's just like, you know, we're thinking about like the pandemic and mortality and what have you. And, you know, I got to say that, I don't know, as Chili always says, you could like walk out in the street and get hit by a bus tomorrow, you know. But I would say it was a good life. It's been a good life. You know, it's been an interesting life. It's been a great life. But I would say the last meal, you know, would probably be my mother's crab curry. Yeah, she makes this excellent crab curry.
Yeah. You have to tell us like a little bit about it.
So
yeah, what kind of curry?
Growing up in Monterey, you know, we have access to the most amazing seafood. And so whenever family would come in town, you know, like the Indian way of doing things is to show your hospitality and largesse. So we'd go to Fisherman's Wharf, we'd get Dungeness crab, and you saute it with onions and garlic and curry powder and saute it all up. And then it's served with like a sauce. Mm. And then you have it with rice. And then you just do it like, you know, what is that? The angry crab style. Like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Just get in there.
Love it.
And it's so good. But I would crack my crab and then pile it up on a plate. Rather than like people would eat it and then kind of go with the rice. No, I would prepare prepare the area.
I know what you mean. You want every bite to be like the complete.
And then I would eat the rice. It's like, but like my very own, like, I don't know if you've ever had jollof rice before.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it was kind of like my version of like Indian jollof rice.
Mmm.
Crab meat folded in.
And you're having this whole thing with champagne, start to finish.
Yeah, which might be not a great, maybe rosé champagne because it is spicy. Mm. And I tell you, like, I get like the most amazing food and wine pairing requests from him.
I mean, all the time. I literally will be at home. And
he's
Drew,
like, I feel bad. I'm like, no, don't. I love the challenge.
I love that I have my own personal master sommelier that I have access to.
Seriously.
I wish I had known, because I would have definitely been like, hey, Alpina, what's the best pairing for tater tots?
Totally. But what is the best pairing for tater tots?
Give me business idea. I should start like a Patreon account where you can text me.
Oh my God.
I'm telling you.
Totally.
Can you imagine?
Yes. So tater tots, go.
Yeah, what is it?
Tater tots. Pairing for tater tots?
Yes.
What are they, like just crispy, crunchy tater tots?
Crispy, crunchy tater tots.
You know, I gotta say champagne would be it.
Mm. Yeah, but I drink with them. Yeah.
It's fried, it's crispy, it's crunchy. And then, you know, you kind of have a little champagne. If you wanted to take kind of the ketchup approach with
it. I was going
to
ask.
Then you could do something like a Mencia or a Frappato, some like high acid, fruit forward red, that kind of mimics the effect of ketchup.
Ugh.
Look at this. See?
That's amazing.
Nobody does it better.
No.
What if you like to dip it in mayo?
Dip it in mayo, then you want to go with like a Chardonnay. Probably.
Then you want to take that shit back to Europe is what you want to do.
That's right. That's right.
That's fine. But I can't go. I won't be allowed in.
A really good girl. Do you remember Crew in Uptown? Remember my heart attack casserole that was on the
your menu? Tater tot casserole.
Yeah, so it's tater. I gotta actually do it and put it on the blog, but it's got a sausage gravy with bacon,
yep,
and cheese, and
yes, please, like,
let's do it.
Good breakfast. Yeah, it's a heart attack casserole. I don't know if that's still politically correct to use that term.
No, it's okay. People still have heart attacks.
Yeah, heart attacks don't.
That didn't stop in the pandemic.
Heart attacks don't know color. if you could also come up with a vegetarian option for that too, because
okay, I'll see if
Drew
I can
doesn't
vegan crumbles.
Do the bacon anymore.
Vegan crumbles. Okay, last but not least, what is your favorite curse word?
Well, the F word.
You can say it.
Say it.
I mean, it's the best word in the English language. You can create an entire word, you know, fuck, was it? Fuck this fucking shit, you know, or fuck
yeah.
This fuck.
Yeah. It's like it's like verb, noun, adjective, adverb.
Fuckly.
I was very lucky, like, you know, my parents did not believe in censorship or editing or whatever. And it's not that they were like this like liberal parenting. They were just so busy working that they didn't have time to oversee what we were doing. But it ended up being in the best interest of, you know, for me. But yeah, like we would just watch like Eddie Murphy and like Richard Pryor and like we were never ever like you can't say that or this or that, whatever. So I think that probably explains a lot. My mother has a potty mouth, so maybe that has a lot to do with it. So.
Yeah.
Love a mother with a potty mouth. There's nothing better. All right,
anyway,
you passed. She passed short
you
order.
Did.
Yeah, with flying colors.
Flying colors. Hey. Yeah. Well, Alpina, this really has been super fun. You know, like I said, we had been trying to get you on for a while. And I think, you know, now with everything that's going on and being able to talk about disparities in the wine business has been incredibly enlightening. And to hear it from your perspective as well.
Yes, we're so grateful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity. And if I could just close out, you know, if somebody's listening out there and they want to pursue the wine business, they want to be a chef, you know, and they're a person of color, you know, like, is it hard to overcome these barriers? Yes. You know, should they not exist? No. But it doesn't mean that you can't still do it. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. It's just so I just encourage, like, it just kills me to think that when I look around my life and everything I've done and, you know, and I think that had I listened to those people that none of this would have been possible. And it's theft, you know, it's theft.
Yeah.
I you know, please don't let anybody steal that from you.
Oh, I love that.
Great advice.
Thank you for being you. Thank you for being a mentor and just for being someone that people can look up to and say, I can do this. It's really great. We're grateful you're in Chicago.
Yeah, you're really cool.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you for having a sense of humor.
Yes. Sometimes it's just laugh to keep from crying, you know?
Right. So yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you. Thank you for all of my own personal wine recommendations.
I know, what the hell?
Well, thank you so much for being here. Thank you guys out there listening and tuning in once again to another episode of Overserved. We will see you next time. I saw you.